The Strange Identity of Jesus Christ. This is, in some ways, kind of weird material. I certainly found this striking, and I've never seen this information pulled together very well, and it seems to be very little understood. Some of you may have come to a talk of mine a year or so ago here on the quest for the historical Jesus, which I talked about who Jesus was or was likely to have been historically. This is not that lecture. This lecture is about who the early Christians, specifically the ones who wrote the New Testament, thought Jesus was. One thing that you need to understand first is there were a lot of different faith communities, as they were called, almost immediately after Jesus' time, who understood Jesus' teachings in all sorts of different ways and who thought he was all sorts of different things, ranging from nothing more to a man to almost a phantom who materialized but didn't really exist in this, you know, corrupt physical world. We only know of most of these groups through the writings of their enemies and a stray text or two that has survived. Why? Because their writings were destroyed, there's very, very little known about them comparatively. So what we have is the what one could call mainstream Christianity, or what became such. And this was far less unified than everybody believes, or at least believed until recently, but it did create what we now know as Christianity. And so part of this is the New Testament, the text in the New Testament. So what I'm going to say here about all of this is to a greater or another based on who the authors of the New Testament, the books in the New Testament, thought Jesus was, which is, I say, fairly consistent. And it's not quite identical to what people were told later. So, who is Jesus? Yet another example of my inability to find high-resolution free art on the internet. He did live. He was not invented out of some kind of concoction of foreign gods by some unknown group, as you sometimes hear argued. He was a historical figure, and what scholars will say, although they agree about not a great deal else, they will agree that he was born probably between 8 and 5 BC in the reign of Herod the Great, the king who slaughtered the innocents, if you remember that story, although scholars don't believe Herod did anything like that. And Jesus died around AD 30. He was crucified under Pontius Pilate, who was governor of Judea between 26 and 36 AD. Now, all sources, you know, pretty much say that, and that is what is known and can be reasonably said to be, you know, certain as one wants to be about the past. Beyond that, the details become rather vague. And I'm going to start here, what the early Christians thought, as I say, this group of early Christians, the part that later became what we know as Christianity thought. And I may as well start with Mark, which is the oldest canonical gospel. There are four gospels in the New Testament, as you know, and although Matthew comes first, nobody believes, I'm talking about mainstream scholarly opinion, when I say everybody and most people. I'm talking about mainstream scholarly opinion, the sort of thing you are likely to learn, you know, if you go to a reputable divinity school and take a course in New Testament 101. Mark is the oldest gospel, and it's considered to be the most historically reliable. That is to say, it has the fewest legends and accretions and insertions by the later authors or the opinions of later believers. That, by the way, is the Mark of the Lion of Saint Mark in the plaza in Venice. Saint Mark is the symbol is the lion, and he's the patron saint of Venice. So who does Mark say Jesus was? Well, here's one thing. Jesus is going out, and he's accosted by this blind man. And the blind man says, "Jesus, thou son of David, have mercy on me." So, according to this, it was fairly well known that Jesus was, or was believed to be, descended from King David. This is also in basically all the earliest sources, including many of the books of the New Testament, if not all of them, in one way or another. So he was believed to be the descendant of King David. And he himself here is alluding to this by saying, "How say the scribes that the Christ," that means the Messiah, "is the son of David?" So, Jesus is the son of David, and this is, he is considered, at least in the context of the New Testament, to be the Messiah, the anointed one. Now, what does this mean? Well, it isn't wildly clear. Here's a verse from Jeremiah, written, I don't know, very early in the 6th century AD. And this is a prophecy. "Behold, the day is come, saith the Lord, that I will raise unto David a righteous branch, and a king shall reign and prosper, and shall execute judgment and justice in the earth." Now, the historical context of this time wasn't looking too good, because the little tiny kingdom of Judah made the big mistake of revolting against Babylon, which was the superpower of its time. And as a result, the Babylonians came, destroyed Jerusalem, and they took the last king in the line of David, whose name was Zedekiah, and they made him stand there and watch while his sons were killed. And then they put out his eyes and put him in prison for the rest of his life. That was the last king of the line of David. And this was the way things were going when this verse was uttered. There was never again another Davidic king on the throne, ever, period. Notice, there's a prophecy that he will come back. A king in the line of David will come back and execute judgment and justice in the earth. It's even starting to sound a bit universal. So this, there was some expectation that eventually somebody from the line of David would come back and rule. That was a prophecy. I mean, that was in sacred scripture. So it was believed and taken seriously. So this king had to be of the line of David. Now, this Messiah, was not discussed as widely in Jesus' own time as you think. There's a widespread belief that there was a widespread expectation that a Messiah was coming, but there aren't too many references to the Messiah in the other literature, that survived from Jesus' time. Like what? Like this. A lot of this is the literature from Jesus' time. This is the Old Testament pseudepigrapha, of which this is one out of two volumes. And it has all kinds of things that never made it into the Bible. The Treatise of Shem, the Greek Apocalypse of Ezra, Third Baruch, 12 Testaments of the 12 Patriarchs. And I'll quote from a couple of these books later on. These were the texts that were written in those. These texts were written in that time. And they just don't mention the Messiah too much. It wasn't really a part of it. Now, was Jesus descended from David? Well, Matthew and Luke say he was, but their genealogies don't agree. Matthew says that Jesus descended from David through Solomon, and Luke said that Jesus descended from David through David's son Nathan. And this has puzzled. All right, these gospels, right, were eventually accepted both as sacred scripture, both texts, right? They're both in the New Testament. So how could he have these two genealogies? And this has never been satisfactorily answered, assuming you take the genealogies as correct. The best people can do is say, well, actually, maybe what it really means is that the line that Matthew is talking about is his father, and the Luke line from Nathan was through his mother. Of course, if Jesus was born of a virgin birth, being descended from his father kind of didn't really entirely count. That's the best anyone has been able to do. Scholars today just don't think either, don't put a great deal of faith in either one. In short, Jesus was believed to be descended from David, and whether he really was is impossible to say. That is to say, biologically, was Jesus descended from King David? Well, we're never going to really know this because we have neither anything like even remotely resembling DNA from either David or Jesus. And David is a fairly shadow figure himself, by the way, which is, you know, would be another lecture. So, but it is possible, I think, to say that at the time he was believed to be. Is this possible? Well, I think so. I mean, the Jews had been living continuously. They'd come back from the Babylonian exile, and they lived pretty much continuously in Judea from that time until Jesus' time. So there was a lot of continuity. There were genealogies. There's one story that said that Herod burned all the genealogies because he wanted to obscure his own rather humble background. But even if that's true, even if he got every last one, people have memories and their family traditions. And particularly in a society that was much more oriented toward the past than ours is, they would, if they thought they were descended from David, they would probably keep that tradition alive. So that much is plausible. How genuine this tradition is, well, who knows? Well, hey, if Jesus was like from this royal line, hey, I mean, wasn't he like a carpenter or something? You know, it's kind of a crummy job for like a royal scion to have. Well, supposedly, but you know, as you know, there's nothing more common in the world than aristocratic families who've fallen on hard times. So that doesn't hardly contradicts one. So I think that can be said safely. And this messianic status was kind of vague. I do not believe that he himself understood this in political terms. Although you will see arguments even in fairly recent books that are. The thing is, if he was going around making these political statements, well, where are they? Well, he doesn't actually talk much about politics of any sort. So if you want to believe he was kind of leading a rebellion against Rome, well, you have to make up a lot of data that for some reason, by your own theory, must have been lost or suppressed, and throw away all the data you actually have, which is very, very poor historical practice. And it's just, you know, it's a file under special pleading. Nonetheless, you can read best-selling works to this day who argue this. It's, you know, somebody is reading this stuff. Now, here's where it gets interesting. Here's the other side of it, another aspect of it. The Son of Man. Jesus was referred to as the Son of Man. Here, in this verse, the Son of Man indeed goeth, as is written of him, but woe to that man by whom the Son of Man is betrayed. Now, that's at the Last Supper, and it's pretty clear that he has Judas in mind. So he's thinking of himself as the Son of Man, if these verses are genuine. I have to back up and say, the four oldest gospels, according to most scholars, are the ones in the New Testament. They were all written between 70 and 100 AD. I think you could make an argument that there's another one called the Gospel of Thomas that maybe is older, but that is not universally accepted. So these are the best historical sources we have for Jesus. At the same time, every scholar admits that a certain amount of legendary material must have got in at some point. They do not agree in the slightest bit about how much there is. Most scholars would say, for example, that the Gospel of John has very, very little historical backing. A typical scholar would very likely say, you know, none of that happened, the changing of water to wine, all of Jesus's claims in I am the way, truth, and life. Their theory, a widespread belief is that he never said that. That's why I'm focusing on Mark, because that's the one that's considered to be the oldest and may have the most connection to what happened. So, according to Mark, he's the Son of Man, which is an extremely weird expression. So weird that, I mean, if you read present theological interpretation, like, they're almost comical. It's like, you know, the exam you wrote, you know, when you didn't go any of the courses and didn't go to any lectures and didn't do any of the reading. It's just like, well, Jesus emphasizes very much his humanity and his very deep connection with the human race. I mean, you know, it's embarrassing to read some of this stuff by serious theologians. All right, this is from the book of Daniel in the Old Testament. And this is a reference to, this is a vision. One like the Son of Man came with the clouds of heaven and came to the Ancient Days, and they brought him near before him, presumably the Ancient of Days. Okay. Now, if a Christian reads this, it seems very, very obvious what they're talking about, because the Son of Man, you know, is the Son, Jesus. The Ancient of Days is God the Father, right? That would be a very, very easy step for a contemporary Christian to make. But here's a funny question. Daniel was written around 165 BC. And Daniel, so that's 200 years before anyone thought of anything like Christianity. So what did Daniel, who's a Jew, think the Son of Man was? There obviously was a Son of Man in Judaism. So who was he? Now, I want to say this, it's kind of a minor point, but in most of the Old Testament, the Son of Man simply is just another way of saying man. What is man that thou art mindful of him, and the Son of Man that thou carest for him, or something like that. In the book of Ezekiel, God keeps calling Ezekiel Son of Man, which just means like human. It's only in the book of Daniel, which is perhaps not coincidentally the latest, probably the last book in the Bible to have actually been written, there's this figure called the Son of Man. This is from a text in this book, First Enoch, which is kind of a complex collection and has material from lots of different dates. But here's a description of the Son of Man. Son of Man is named in the presence of the Lord of Spirits, and is named before the end at the head of days, before the suns and the constellations were created, his name was named before the Lord of Spirits. So there's, the Lord of Spirits. Well, who's that? Well, it's probably the Ancient of Days that we just saw in the previous verse, and the Son of Man. So he is a kind of a pre-existent figure. I highlighted name because this theme is going to be important, and we'll see where it takes us, because that's part of the story. Right. Here's another description of him. This is from a Jewish philosopher, theologian called Philo, who actually lived around the time of Jesus, although he didn't know about Jesus but to any appearances. And Philo describes him, the word, the eldest of his angels. the great archangel of many names, the name of God and the Word, and man according to God's image. All right, the great archangel of many names. Well, you can already see he's got many names, right? Here are just some of them. Here are some of the others. He was the great angel, archangel, the Son of Man, the Son of God, the name of God. I think right here you see the Word. Is this starting to sound familiar? And he was even called a second God, which in Greek is Deuteros Theos, which, you know, this is kind of striking because, you know, the whole thrust of Judaism is monotheism, right? There's only one God, and by some coincidence, he happens to be ours, but, you know, talking about a second God, this is kind of radical. But there are many texts, like the one in Enoch and in Philo, that say something very much like this. So this figure was very, very important. And he was kind of the highest of all angels. He was created before all the other angels. Now, the name of God is interesting. Most of you probably know that modern Jews are forbidden to pronounce the name of God, or the proper name of God, which is supposedly Yahweh. I don't think that's the correct pronunciation, but you're not supposed to say that because it's too sacred. And the reason that's so sacred is that the name and the thing in Semitic thought were very, very heavily linked. In fact, in Hebrew, the word for thing and word, the word for word and the word for thing are the same. So the name is the thing in a way that we don't, for us, a name is simply a label. You can call it a chair, you can call it, as our Jewish friends say, you could call it chopped liver. But that was not the way they thought, and that's particularly not the way they thought of God. So he was the name. This is, by the way, if you want a technical term for it, this is a hypostasis, which means something like a personification. In a sense, this angel was the personification of the name. To this day, by the way, pious Jews will still call God, I mean the high God, the Hashem, which means the name. And there's a little Hasidic song which consists of one lyric repeated over and over again, which is, God is one and his name are one. And in fact, hey, it's actually in the Bible, the book of Exodus. Or my name is in him. And that was one of his names. Metatron still appears in the Kabbalah to this day, but you know, the average Christian, the average Jew probably never heard this name, or if they have, they certainly have an idea. My name is in him. Well, that's what we just saw, right? My name is in him. This is one theory about where Metatron's name came from. One theory. Well, here it is, Yahweh. This is called the Tetragrammaton, four letters. Tetra, four, Metatron. I'm not sure I'm totally convinced by this theory myself. In fact, I don't think it's widely understood, but it is kind of ingenious. Here's another one that's a little more plausible. Meta tu tranu, in Greek, the angel with the throne. That makes more sense to me. It's one of those things that there are lots of explanations, and none of them is like really quite, you know, kind of clicked with scholars. But this is the one that's probably, you know, the one that's most accepted. And who is Metatron? Well, here's something else. This is from a similar text. In fact, supposedly by Enoch, but Metatron says, I am Enoch, the son of Jared. The Holy One, blessed be, took me from their midst to be a witness against them in the heavenly height. So, by one theory, Enoch was elevated as the human being. Oh, Enoch, what about him? This is another widespread thing. He was translated that he should not see death. That is to say, Enoch was not believed to have died. It simply says that he walked with God and God took him. This is in the book of Genesis. He's a very mysterious figure, but because he's so mysterious and because, wow, it's like God didn't even let him die. I mean, that's kind of impressive. So then the legend became that, you know, instead of dying, he was raised up and made the highest angel. Another little twist to this is, in the Kabbalah, sometimes it's said that Enoch was elevated to the place where Lucifer had fallen from. Lucifer had been like the top angel in the sense when that, as it were, vacancy, position became vacant, Enoch was kind of promoted, hired from outside, I guess, since he had already been an angel. So this is a summary of a lot of what I told you. So here's Enoch, who gets elevated to the great angel. Now that is Jewish thought. The Christians never associated Enoch with Jesus, to my knowledge, ever. It would be interesting. Well, if Jesus knew of this, Jesus thought he was the Son of Man, and he'd heard that the Son of Man was supposed to be Enoch. Did he think it was the reincarnation of Enoch? It's a fascinating thing, but I've never even heard any scholar think about it, and there's no evidence for it. What the Christians believed was this. There was this great angel who's above everything else in creation, including all the other angels, and he became incarnated in Jesus, who was the Son of Man, the Son of God, the Word, all of which he's called in the New Testament. And Jesus suffered and died, and was resurrected, and then became glorified, seated at the right hand of God. So God, he's sort of put next to God. Sounds almost like that second God we were talking about earlier. So what happened to Metatron? Well, this is what happened in Christianity. Jesus is the Son of Man, the Son of God, the Word, the Logos. Thus, he is the incarnation of Metatron, the great angel. That was the belief, obviously, of Mark, who wrote the Gospel of Mark. It was the belief of Paul, because I could cite verses from Paul that say the same thing. And the author of the Hebrews. No one knows who wrote this. This is an anonymous text. It was sometimes attributed to Paul, but nobody even believed that even in antiquity. We've seen that God was, the angel was kind of the creative agent of God, who actually made everything. By him all things were made, the opening of the beginning of the Gospel of John, and without him nothing was made that was made. Well, that's what John was thinking of. Philo, as we've seen, called him the Logos, which it sort of means word and it sort of doesn't, but you know, for purposes of our discussion now, we can take it as meaning that. John is basically associating the Logos, the great angel, with Jesus. So that's a lot of the New Testament right there. So what happened to Metatron? According to Christianity, so you see he got promoted. He already started as higher than anybody else, but then God made him equal or virtually equal to himself. In fact, in Catholic Christianity, which is the mainstream Christianity, all Christian sects, practically all Christian sects, are, you know, come out of Catholic Christianity, by which I mean Catholicism and Orthodoxy. I mean, from the Catholic's point of view, all Protestant churches are simply heresies of Catholicism. Of course, everyone is a heretic in everyone else's eyes. It just adds to the fun. So eventually it became that the Son has always been equal to God. The three persons of the Trinity, each of the persons is God, whole and entire. Each of the persons has all the divine attributes in their fullness. So it wasn't that Jesus was an angel who got promoted, which is what the early Christians actually thought, but he had always been equal to God right from the very start. I realize this is a lot of detail, and I hope I'm not going through it too fast, but I will say that I've never really seen this material presented in anything like a comprehensible fashion. And you will see, you know, like in some of these texts, they mention the Son of Man, right? And so, you know, you'll see a scholar write, well, this presence of the Son of Man may indicate Christian influence. Well, no, it doesn't indicate Christian influence at all. This was a completely Jewish idea that was completely part of the Jewish mainstream. All of this thing about the Logos, the Word, the great angel. I once went into a seminar at the Society for Biblical Literature, which was kind of the foremost body for studying such things. And the debate was this whole thing about this kind of God, this Logos, the Son of Man. And the debate was whether, as they put it, this idea was normative in first century Judaism, or was it just a normative means everybody believed it, or most everybody believed it, or only some people believed it. So it was definitely there. I don't even remember what these scholars concluded, as I remember it wasn't anything terribly conclusive. But that idea existed in Judaism, and Jesus' understanding, theoretically, of himself. Did Jesus believe he was the Son of Man? Well, that kind of goes back to, here's a verse, Mark. Jesus saying he's the Son of Man. But hey, the typical scholar doesn't believe that even all of Mark goes back to what actually happened. This is just the closest, right? You know, like the joke about the kid who gets a prize for guessing how many legs a hippopotamus has. The mother says, how many did you guess? I said, three. So, well, that's just wrong. You know, it was four. He said, yeah, but I came the closest. And so Mark is kind of like this. He comes the closest. So then, well, did Jesus really say this? Well, your answer, if you're a scholar, is going to depend very, very much on your your kind of idea of who Jesus was. There are no external sources against which to test the Gospels in the New Testament, except maybe the Gospel of Thomas, as I say, but that's actually almost sometimes even more cryptic than the ones in the Bible. So you can exclude some of the things in the Gospels as legend, things that was said about him later, and you can keep some. How do you decide? There are no external criteria to judge. There's no there are no copies of, you know, the Jerusalem Daily Bugle from April 33 AD say, you know, Jesus, you know, the alleged Son of David, Son of Man, was crucified this afternoon. There's nothing, just nothing. So you're going to exclude this. I mean, there are other grounds, you know, like, well, is this in a lot of sources? Or is it just one? Is it in early sources? Well, if it's in a lot of sources and it's in early sources, you have a pretty good chance of believing it. But hey, this is in all the sources. This is an early source. You have to take this seriously. So, by all accounts, he seemed to have had this idea. Now, you could say, well, maybe his thought changed. Maybe he sort of started with this Son of David thing and eventually decided he was the great angel incarnated or something. You could say that. That is possible. But in order to say that, you would have to know another thing that nobody knows. Right? Jesus' historical life. Well, he was born. All the sources agree that he was baptized by John, and after that he died and was crucified. And he, in between his baptism and his death, he did a number of things in between. Nobody knows the order of these things. Because even the oldest gospel, Mark, and the oldest testimony of the gospel of Mark comes from the 2nd century AD. And he says, well, Mark was Peter's interpreter. You know, Peter, I guess, didn't know Greek or Latin, and Mark supposedly did his interpreter. Mark wrote down what Peter said about Jesus. But Papias is the name of the source, goes on to say, Mark did not write these things down in order, and Peter did not mention them in order. He just made a point of saying everything Jesus said and did, leaving nothing out, and that was it, making sure it was accurate. So even the oldest source that's talking about Mark, can't give any kind of explanation or account of, when the miracles happened, when this happened, when he did this, when he did that. They're kind of isolated stories. So did his thinking about himself change? Maybe, but you would have to know what he said first and what he said later, which we do not know. And again, how can you organize it? Well, you can organize it according to your own preconception of what should have happened, but that's totally circular. Totally circular. Very, very few studies of Jesus by scholars are avoid the circularity. And I'm not sure you completely can, but I think you should be honest about it, which they're usually not, possibly even to themselves. Where are we here? So that the Son was always equal to God. This happens to be a source I chose more or less at random, Catholicism, but it represents mainstream. It represents the doctrine of the Catholic Church. Let's put it that way. Judaism. What happened to him there? Well, it actually, they decided they'd had enough of this thing. All right, I'll tell you the story first. This heretical rabbi. This is from the book Third Enoch, which is again in this Old Testament pseudepigrapha. Heretical rabbi sends him and sees Metatron on the throne. He says, there are indeed two powers of heaven. Remember the second God, the Deuteros Theos? Then God himself dethrones Metatron. The angel Anapiel comes, and, well, I'll read the passage. Let's see, I will read it to you. But when Aher came to behold the vision of the chariot, Metatron is talking, but when Aher came to behold the vision of the chariot and set eyes upon me, he was afraid and trembled before me. His soul was alarmed to the point of leaving him because of his fear, dread, and terror of me when he saw me seated upon a throne like a king, with ministering angels standing beside me as servants and all the princes of kingdoms crowned with crowns surrounding me. Princes of kingdoms is angels, not earthly kings, which is another story. Then he opened his mouth and said, there are indeed two powers in heaven. Immediately a divine voice came out of the presence of the Shekinah, which means the presence, and says, come back to me, apostate sons, apart from Aher. Then Anapiel, Yahweh the honored, glorified, beloved, wonderful, terrible, and dreadful prince came at the command of the Holy One and struck me with 60 lashes of fire and made me stand to my feet. Now, I mentioned this guy called Acher, this heretical rabbi. And that wasn't really his name, because Acher is Hebrew, and it simply means the other one, and not in a nice way. Acher was kind of, his real name was Elisha ben Abuya. He lived around the turn of the second century AD, and he became a heretic of some kind, probably a Christian. And this text is blaming this idea of Metatron, which was in Judaism, for turning people to heresy. So the idea was Metatron better get demoted back to put back in his place. No more throne for Metatron. And although Metatron, as I say, still exists, you know, in the Kabbalah, the idea of Metatron still exists in the Kabbalah today. He's never had the kind of importance he had in Judaism in the first century, because there's a famous story in which Acher figures. It's in the Talmud, and it said four rabbis ascend into heaven. One of them dropped dead on the spot. Another went mad. The third became a heretic. This is Acher. And only one, whose name was Akiva, actually came back in good shape. And what Akiva said after all that was, when you see come to the place of the shining stones, do not say water, water, for it is written, a liar shall not enter the kingdom of heaven. That's what it says. It's very cryptic, but that's what Akiva thought was worth bringing back from, shall we say, above. So Acher obviously had some kind, and these visions, you know, we don't really know how they were produced. There was a lot of visionary experience. And, you know, the book of Ezekiel in the Bible is filled with it. A lot of these pseudepigraphal texts are filled with it. The book of Revelation is one example of the genre. It's the most famous. But how they got this experience, how they, you know, did, are they just kind of, you know, sitting around in the backyard one day and, you know, all of a sudden happened? Do they have meditative, contemplative techniques? They probably did, but we don't know what they are. So, but who is Jesus really? Well, was Jesus the Christ? Well, one could say that the Christ esoterically is the kind of combined human race. That is to say, all of us are kind of cells in this body. The Catholics call this the mystical body of Christ, for example. This happens to be from A Course in Miracles, which is a text I happen to like. But I think it's a profound thing, at least to leave oneself with. And finally, the commercial. This is my next book, a lot of this material is in it. How God Became God. Which is weird stuff. I mean, they thought really Jesus was the great angel. That's bizarre. I mean, there are a lot more bizarre things too in it, but that's what this book is about. Now, here's another more bizarre fact. This has an article called God and the Great Angel. And if it weren't confusing enough, this all happened twice. All of this happened with Jesus, but something very similar. Yahweh was originally not the one high God. Yahweh was the angel of Israel. It happened, the whole thing happened twice, which is very, very weird. Yahweh got promoted to God himself. El was the high God, and Yahweh was the ruling angel of Israel. So you pick up the Bible, and it says, the Lord is God. Well, how fascinating. I mean, it sounds redundant and boring, but no, that's not what it's really saying. It's saying Yahweh is El. The ruling angel of Israel is the high God. If you understand this, a lot of things, and there are many puzzling verses in the Bible referring to the angel of the Lord, and like Yahweh being the angel. That happened all over again, and why, I don't know. I mean, there are, it evokes some reflections and some possibilities. Yahweh became identified with El, the high god, in the 6th century. This certainly happens in the second book, second Isaiah, the portion of the book of Isaiah that was written in the 6th century BC. So it probably happened by then. And all of this, obviously with Jesus, it happened in the 1st century.
So who developed this Trinity? I mean, I know you're kind of alluding to it, but it's...
possibly an arch-heretic. This is no joke.
Yeah, I can see.
The first reference to the doctrine of the Trinity that we know of is the title of a work by the Gnostic bishop Valentinus, considered an arch-heretic, titled something like, I forget the exact title, but it's on the hypostases, the three persons of the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. This work is lost. We only know its title. The only reason we even know its title is that when there was all sorts of this controversy about the doctrine of the Trinity, a guy who opposed it said, well, this is nothing more than the doctrine of Valentinus in, you know, this work. So Valentinus, the central doctrine of Christian theology, was it thought of by an arch heretic? Well, history is full of weirdnesses. But I mean, there was a bishop named Alexander in the 4th century AD who was kind of the spearhead of this idea of the Trinity. The Council of Nicaea in AD 325 basically created the doctrine that we now know and love, or not. But Athanasius was kind of his sidekick, and Athanasius was very influential in promoting it. That's why the church has the Athanasian Creed. He didn't write it. Nobody really believes Athanasius wrote it, but you know, he was a very, very major figure. Athanasius, another interesting thing about Athanasius is that he may have, in his curious kind of way, finalized the canon of the New Testament, the text of the New Testament. Because he sent an Easter letter in 367 AD saying, these are the books you should read. These are the books that are beneficial for salvation. All the others are junk, get rid of them. And those 27 books that he names are the books in the New Testament. That's the first reference to the New Testament canon as we have it. So, a lot of fascinating stuff.
So, can you explain the logic of the story of the rabbi that noticed there's two powers and all of a sudden God says, I'm going to demote this guy. Where's the logic in that story?
Yes. Well, it's a mystical vision. I mean, it's a mystical vision. And did it happen? No, not really. Did the guy who wrote it believe it happened? Maybe, maybe not really. But what it points to is that it reflects the fact that Metatron was demoted to a lower status, probably in the wake of Christianity and the uses that Christianity made of the great angel. And because it challenges God's monotheistic supremacy.